the volume.
Hey guys, it's The Sessions presented by FanDuel. The Super Bowl is here, and there's no better place to get in on the action than with FanDuel. FanDuel has awesome exclusive Super Bowl offers for both new and existing users. There's going to be tons of different bets and new markets available for the game. You can combine multiple bets into a same game parlay, and you can continue to jump in on the action at any time with the live betting. And when you win, you get paid fast. Download the FanDuel app today and start making every moment more during Super Bowl 57. Disclaimer, 21 plus in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG for Colorado, Iowa, Minneapolis, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Tennessee, Virginia, and Ohio. 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 for Arizona. 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat for Connecticut. 1-800-9-WITH-IT for Indiana. Visit ksgamblinghelp.com for Kansas. 1-877-770-STOP for Louisiana. Visit www.mdgamblinghelp.org for Maryland. 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY for New York. 1-800-522-4700 for Wyoming or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net in West Virginia. Welcome to The Sessions. How is everybody doing today? Hopefully everybody's feeling good, looking good, doing good, all of the above. I'm currently recording from the floor of where my pseudo studio space used to be. We're like eyeballs deep in renovations at my house. So I'm sitting on like chipped wood floors. I probably have splinters in my ass. But hey, the show goes on, you know? So that being said, I am joined by the legend himself, Samoa Joe. So happy to get Joe on. You know, talk about different moments in his career, things that he's been through, things he's seen, things he's done, how he's, you know, winded up with his time here in AEW, things he wants to leave the next generation with, some matches that he's exceptionally proud of, to his new foray into the acting world and the voiceover world. Also, we get into like his like insane artillery of weapons that he has in his house, and now weapons I have in my house because he likes to send weapons to my husband. We get into the whole thing. It'll all make sense when you listen. All right, guys, enough from me and my splintered butt on this floor. I'm going to hand things over to my guy, Samoa Joe. Enjoy. And a one and a two. Samoa Joe, first of all, you don't look really like thrilled to be here right now.
Well, I'm ecstatic. This is one of the best times I could have used here right now.
You're just like sitting in a dark room.
I'm very sad.
It's funny having a podcast where I have guests twice a week, but like booking people, I always feel bad asking people to do because I know time is precious. Time is precious. Off time is precious.
Come on, Renee. You know, I'll never miss an opportunity to hang out with you.
I know. That's why I was like, oh, I'll pester Joe because I can pester Joe and I'll get him to pop on here. So what does an off day look like for you? What did like today? What did you do today?
Today was nice. Like I said, an off day is kind of rare these days, but woke up, hit the pool, did a nice little cold dip, got my mind right and my punishment done for the day. Hit the gym, came back, had lunch, little fun noodle soup, you know, and called it waiting for the games to start, you know?
Yeah, I feel like on like those like reset days, like today was one of those days for me where I was like, oh, so our house is being completely remodeled right now, essentially. And I'm like sitting in a dirt pile for anyone that's not watching on YouTube right now. I'm sitting in a pile of rubbish, had to work out. I had to shower. I brushed my hair for you. I like this is fresh new hair.
I can tell them those ends finally came together, which I'm really happy about. It's a great job.
They finally came together. But anyways, I feel like it was like a little mental clarity day and then my computer took a shit on me. So now I'm back to ground zero of having a meltdown, which I love. I love those days.
I think what people don't understand is like if you had to describe your normal week in the wrestling industry or whatever, it's pretty much you take your entire life and condense it into like 2 or 3 days. That your home life, you know, and like you got a baby time, groceries, laundry, everything that you need to get done, you got to get done in just this really short window of time.
Okay, so how do you balance that? Because some weeks I feel like I'm getting a good grasp on it, but you've been A, you've been in the wrestling world much longer than I have. You've had kids much longer than I've had. You've been married longer than I have. You've got a leg up on the entire situation. So what, how do you balance it? Do you have a system?
Oh, you get a maid. First off, you'll go find this. So you get a good, awesome maid. You pay her very, very well. And I mean, literally, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, you realize with your time being away from home, I mean, it's just, it limits your ability just to get normal life done. So, I mean, you take shortcuts where you can. Other than that, it's just like, you know, we kind of got like, especially laundry. I think laundry is the biggest wrestler hang up. I think you being married,
oh my
you know,
God,
what the deal is.
It's like
that stuff comes out of that bag pretty right.
It's never
and rough.
Ending.
And it's never ending, especially when you add kids in the equation who, you know, I got a couple boys that, you know, act like shirts are worth 15 minutes worth of time. You strip them off, they got something else on. So it's like, you know, the conveyor belt never stops. But I think the biggest thing is just like communication's big, you know, understanding, you know, how much your significant other can get done during
the week. Well, because Jess works too. Your wife also works. So like she is busy. She is up at the crack of dawn getting things done.
Yeah, she works full time. She's a teacher, loves it. And, you know, it's her passion. So it's like, yeah, we definitely needed to sit down, kind of strategize and figure out what we can get done, what we can't get done, and what we can't get done. Well, you know, you gotta bite the bullet and find somebody to help you come get it done.
What like tips you over the edge? Is there something when you're home, if it's like this is messy or the gas is not in the car or there something like that that pushes you over the edge?
All of the above. I mean, well, because it all annoys you. You know what I mean? You get home, it all makes you angry.
Yeah.
But as the years go on, you start to realize, all right, I can't be mad about everything when I get home because I'm just making myself miserable. So you just kind of, all right, you don't mind stuff as much. But I think my big thing is like, you do not ever, I don't care if it's a life or death emergency, never take the chargers out of my bag.
Oh my God.
Do not touch the tech rage in the bag. There's nothing that makes me more angry than arriving somewhere, digging in that bag, and then just knowing you have to walk over to the Newport News and buy some $80 charger. That's, you know, like it's just, I think that's the biggest. That's the only really thing now. Everything else flows off me. But that one thing, man, if you greatly hinder my travel progress, oh, that's
insane. That is infuriating, especially if you're just missing the plug and you're like, can I plug it my thing into the TV? Is there like going to be one of those switches where you can just not like omit the USB port? Oh my God.
Let's be honest, like the majority of USB ports in hotels and or airports are mad.
Oh, my
like,
God.
You don't want to plug anything into the, I mean, they look rough. You know, I mean, they look like they got like a cough and wheeze when you look at it. Like the USB ports are all jacked up. It's not, not really the healthiest thing you want your phone to be.
I don't think that I've ever actually seen you mad. And what's funny is that like, so while I was like thinking about like things to talk to you about, you are one of the most scariest men. When you switch to walking out the curtain, when you are walking to the ring and you're beelining and you are in Samoa Joe mode, I stay the hell out of your way. I know you pretty well. And you're like one of the sweetest, nicest men, which usually the most dangerous men in the room.
But you also know I can't wait for an opportunity to check in the boards, you know, just kind of put you up against the wall.
But I always feel like it's like the most dangerous guys in the room that don't have to like over exude themselves to let people know that they're a bad motherfucker. They don't have to do that. And that is you. But I've never seen you like ever actually mad. I would love to see that from a distance.
I think it's because you met me a very later version of me, which is maybe kind of toned down a bit and understands the impact of his actions. And has been told that, you know, when I flip out, everybody kind of goes on high alert and it gets weird real fast. So it's like, I mean, that's basically it. I've learned how much trouble comes with outbursts. And trust me, I've probably been prosecuted to the hilt whenever I've popped off and gone crazy and stuff. So, a lot of hindsight is really what it is.
What kind of trouble are we talking here? Are we talking like trouble or just like bratty outbursts?
Both, you know, like for context, I think I'm probably the most fined and suspended guy in TNA history. Maybe not by this point. I don't know.
For what? Like, what kind of things were you doing? I don't know these stories.
I just get upset at, you know, things and I just wouldn't handle it the right way. You know, I flip out. Well, here's the thing. It's never physical. You know, I've never assaulted anybody, never, you know, threatened anybody's life. That's not into me. But I think if anybody's been around when I'm, which I guess you have, when I'm hot and I'm shouting about things, I'm told it's like very terrifying and it seems very like violence is about to pop off and stuff. So, I mean, I think that's really the gist of it. I remember at the time too, it was like anytime I had a big pop off and like somebody else would have something similar. Like I was always punished way more. And it was like, well, you're just scarier. It's like, all right, cool.
Well, I guess if you're scarier, but also if you were doing it more often, you overstepped the boundaries enough already. You were already in the deficit.
Another reason too, is just like, I've had the tremendous opportunity to kind of be in there to kind of, you know, roll around with and mess with some of the baddest dudes in the world. And, you know, that's humbling really, really quick. You know what I mean? You get loop chugged about 3 or 4 times the same way. And the guy tells you how it's coming. I mean, it has a tendency to make you kind of have some clarity on what's a real dangerous situation.
We all need one every now and then, a little danger in your eye. Okay, let's take things back to early days, Joe, because you are from a family of performers. You have been in, you've been an entertainer your entire life. What's it like growing up with a family of performers and just kind of being bred into that environment?
Pretty wild. You know, like I think the transition to pro wrestling is probably the easiest thing I've ever done in life, just because it's the same concept. It's gigging, you know, it's going out there. And I mean this in the gig sense, not the other way.
We're not bleeding.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's gig mentality. It's just, you know, you go out there, you book yourself out, you know, do your night's work and, you know, collect your paycheck and travel home. You know, I'd been on the road and with my family performing full time. And that's like, you know, 3 or 4 shows a week since I was 5.
At like summer games. Is that right?
Yeah, that was my first like dancing debut. Was my father made a terrible miscalculation on how quick the girls could get to and from the 50-yard line, make a costume change and get back out there for the next number. You know, the girls, they did their first routine and we're drumming in the background and they made their way off the field. And my dad looked and realized, okay, 10 seconds going by, 15 seconds. Oh, we're starting to lose the crowd. So he pretty much grabbed me. I was 5 at the time.
You're cute. You get out there.
I remember stall. You know, like it was a stretch. Like, go get him, kid. Stretch. Go get him, Tiger. He's just like, stall. And so, you know, went out there wide-eyed, terrified, did my thing, you know, walked back. I think something like 60,000 people in the LA Coliseum or however how much it holds. Don't quote me on that. And I never had stage fright after that again. It was just like legitimately, like I've never been scared to go up in front of people, never whatever. Cause it was like, after that, it was just shock therapy. It was like, there you are.
Okay. So working with your family though, what are, I guess, like the pros and cons of seeing entertainment through their eyes, learning entertainment through their eyes, and then kind of making the foray into professional wrestling?
The pros are definitely like understanding performance, understanding what an audience is, you know, looking at and what they want comparatively to what you think they want. Understanding, you know, like I said, stage presence, poise, knowing to take your time in front of people because it attracts attention. It doesn't deflect it. It's a lot of like small things that are just stage presence issues immediately translated pro wrestling. And then, you know, from my brothers and sisters perspective, I mean, they're all extremely talented. My brother still runs the show to this day in Southern California. And, you know, like I said, they were all very, very high end Polynesian entertainers. So it was like, I was always kind of striving towards that. And then when I got to pro wrestling, it was a lot like finding my own thing. And, as much passion as my brother had for the Polynesian dancing business, that's what grew for me as far as pro wrestling.
Okay, so you're with your family doing the Polynesian dance troupe. What was the twinkle in your eye to make the transition over to pro wrestling from that?
So I think pro wrestling is probably the only sport team type thing that me and my father watched together. And so and I think generally everyone in my house kind of enjoyed it. You know, they thought it was cool. And really for a lot of Polynesians, you know, pro wrestling was one of the few places, even before the NFL, where you saw actual Samoans on TV, which is wild. I mean, we're a small island in the South Pacific. You know, Offensica, we're like, you know, Jordan and Pippen, yeah, yeah. To a lot of yeah. like young Samoans growing up. Because, you know, it was crazy to see, like, wow, you know, we may be a small island that, you know, everybody thought we were from Hawaii and stuff back in the day. And it's like, to see that was always a big deal. So I think that's kind of what the attraction was initially, was just that it was cool seeing Polynesians on television there. You know, I think I just got to a point where, my relationship with my father really suffered because of the show. You know, the rest of my brothers and sisters kind of exited. We were doing their own thing at the time. It was just me and him and my cousins. You know, it put a lot of stress and strain because, you know, being my boss didn't stop when we got done with the show. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, like imagine having a tyrant of a boss and, you know, he's living in the room down the hall and he's on you 24 hours a day. So, I mean, like, because of that, like me and my dad's relationship suffered tremendously. And like, you know, we had a, you know, huge issues and like, you know, I didn't want to be part of the show anymore. And I was sick of it. And I was sick of being the last guy left. you know, and whatever issues that he may have had, frustrations with other family, took out on me.
Yeah.
And it just manifested, you know, in bad ways. And then when I made the transition to pro wrestling, and I explained to him, and obviously, you know, I paid my fair share into the family pot every time I got my paycheck, you know, he totally understood and he got it. And he knew I was passionate about it. He knew I was good at it. And he couldn't have been more supportive. You know, it's like our relationship kind of like completely did a 180. He became my biggest supporter, my biggest fan, was driving me to LAX in the morning at 5 a.m. to catch flights to the East Coast.
That's a favor if I've ever heard one.
Like getting up being like, you got to make this flight. You know, even, you know, I don't miss flights, but I mean, I remember a few where he woke me up and said, you know, get your ass up, got to get you to flight. And yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that I always appreciate about pro wrestling was kind of a non-intentional side effect, was that it really rebuilt the relationship between me and my father.
What about the sense of like Polynesian pride? I mean, you mentioned Afa and Sika, but looking at what's happening now, I mean, your career, incredible, obviously, and we'll delve into more of that stuff. But I mean, looking at stuff that's happening with like the Bloodline and those guys being like, to see the career of those guys and where they're at, I mean, especially, you know, the Usos who have been in this game for such a long time, from The Rock. I mean, there's just so many prominent Samoan professional wrestlers. What is the sense of pride in that now?
It's overwhelming. You know, obviously, you know, the stuff that the Bloodline are doing been great. You know, the Usos are both real good friends of mine. Roman, you know, he's a good brother. They're all good brothers, you know. And I think for them, it's very much carrying on a legacy that their family started, you know, years past, and really, you know, carrying that legacy probably better than even their forefathers would have hoped. And, you know, for me, I think it's just, it's very much in the same vein, you know, just letting Polynesians know that they're, you know, we're well represented out here in the sporting space.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just continue to try to be like, you know, a good beacon of hope for a lot of kids across the South Pacific, that, you know, a lot of things are possible.
Okay. So young Joe, 5 years old, being thrust into the spotlight at the Summer Games, your career through professional wrestling. I mean, you have been there and done so many different things, working different promotions, carrying championships, having all these amazing things. Now at 43?
Sounds about right. I think, check Wikipedia.
I actually just hit that age where I go, I'm 35. No, bitch, you ain't. You're 37. Keep up. I'm mid 30s. No, you're actually late 30s. What is your relationship with performing now? You've been doing it for so long. And I mean, even outside of the wrestling world, I mean, now you're doing the voiceover work. You're doing so many different things. What is your relationship with entertaining now?
It is super measured, I think, is the best way to describe it. Like, and I think you've seen it too. A lot of people do, especially like you said, like I'm definitely like walk through the curtain, then it's on. But previous to the curtain, and I think you can attest to this, I'm probably goofy as hell backstage or talking, you know, thinking about anything but me walking out there.
Yeah, you're thinking of different ways to insult me.
Well, I mean, that's like, you know, breathing in and breathing out. But I think that's the biggest thing. It's just it's a lot more controlled, but it's just because of experience. You know, it's just because I've been in that spot so many times and I've walked through that curtain so many times. And yeah, I tell people like, oh, you know, guys, you don't get a charge anymore. I go, no, the charge is there. It's just I know what it feels like.
Does that ever like affect you in a way that you're like, man, I wish? I guess you don't. It's not like feel like wishing.
Oh, absolutely. No, I wish I could get that buzz back. You know, that nervous. Oh, you know, my destiny's through this curtain. Yeah.
I know. It makes me a little sad almost of like, man, but it's great. I mean, to be so lucky to have a career where you've been able to scratch so many of those itches and now to be able to look back on it in that way. But I know to like get that rush again.
Well, it's funny. Like I'll see guys now, especially in AEW, because there's just a lot of younger guys who are just kind of coming into their own. And I see it, you know, and I see just that biting tension and just that, oh, my, you know, and I'm just like, oh man, I remember that feeling. You know, it's like, it's funny because right now they're probably thinking it's terrifying and it's horrible and it's churning them and pulling them in all different directions. But at the same
time, until they're done with it and then they love it.
And then there's, oh, it's this big release and they're all great and stuff. And yeah, I think that's what it is. You know, really performance is essentially kind of a guided endorphin rush. I've been on the trip so much. It's just easier to guide those endorphins.
What would like your advice be to essentially the entire AEW roster, because there is so many really young wrestlers. It is a young roster. What's your advice that you would give to people that are kind of just starting, just getting that television experience and kind of learning those ropes? I mean, even guys that are well-seasoned pro wrestlers that maybe don't have that television experience.
I think gauging your thoughts behind eliciting reactions from the crowd and how to get it rather than, you know, just worrying about the minutiae of what you're doing and you know, like not worrying about the details, but worrying about the destination, I think is kind of what I'm getting at, where I feel like, you know, a lot of guys are really stuck on the technicality of what they're doing and not the reason why they're doing it. And I think that's my biggest advice I would offer to anybody, you know, AEW, WWE is just, you know, it's awesome that you can do it, but why are you doing it? I think just bring that essence of reality to it, just having a reason for everything you do. You know, I hate the term less is more. I think it's kind of an open invitation to be really lazy, but I love saying get the most out of everything you do. I mean, I think it's a better way of saying that.
Squeeze that juice out, baby.
Yeah, get to the pith.
Yeah, get it all out. Okay, so the past, 5 years have been like quite an up and down for you.
I've seen beyond that. I mean, probably past decade's been pretty wild.
Okay, so from going from TNA into NXT, your entire run at NXT to being on the main roster, to doing commentary, being released, being brought back, the ups, the downs. What was like the soul searching that was happening during those moments of just trying to figure out what is next, what you wanted to still kind of give back to the wrestling world at that point? Because I mean, I know you and I had, you know, many conversations kind of in between some of those spots. But yeah, just sort of, I guess, like that uncertainty that comes with this life. And the injuries on top of that, you got some wacky injuries too.
Oh, for sure. You know, and the concussion by far is probably the worst thing. But you know, in general, I think what happened with TNA during that time to the transition to NXT was obviously very unique and very unusual. You know, for Hunter to take that type of chance and kind of go against internal dogma by the people that were there at the time, was a big thing. You know, and he offered me a great initial deal. And after that went well, he offered me a better one. I think he offered me like two more that were even better than that as we kept going. And then we were finally in business, like properly full time. And yeah, I mean, for me, that was kind of just validation as far as like, you know, all the work that I'd done was not, and you know, all the time spent and all that was all for good. And then, you know, being released from WWE the first time,
it was very bizarre. I will say from the outside, because I was already gone at that point, I was like, what the fuck? It just made no sense.
I deign to say that initially there, as I understand it, unconfirmed, you know, there was issues between the two upper echelons of management, and they were playing out their war with the careers and the contracts of the people underneath them. So, you know, after the initial one, I mean, I didn't have much of a chance to grieve because essentially I was hired back within hours.
Because I think I was like, wait, can you do my podcast now? And you're like, nope.
Yeah, I think I had to tell you good no, because they're going to want me back. And then the second time, I just kind of chuckled because I realized it was very much the same situation. But at the same time, I mean, I wasn't bitter or mad. I mean, the truth of it is, you know, really to and this is to give, you know, I guess WWE some credit, was that I was expensive. You know, I was expensive to keep around. And if, you know, cutting my contract, if they say that saved the company money, trust me, I believe it did. So I wasn't like hot about that. You know, it was like, it was just more than just the silliness of the situation and what they were doing. And the reasoning why they were doing it, but which I can't, you know, you can never officially confirm, but I've heard from enough people that I have a pretty good idea what we're doing. So, including many of the people involved. So after that, it was kind of like, I think I spent a day kind of pissed. And like I said, more at the situation than the actual firing. And then like all these like super awesome opportunities literally materialized out of nowhere.
Isn't it crazy how that happens? That like, I feel like that, I feel like when you put in the work, which obviously you do, I feel like you kind of get met on the other end with all the other opportunities.
I can confirm that is absolutely the case. You know, like I really wish I could say it was some, you know, miracle stroke of luck, but it was just literally, it was kind of refreshing to see that a lot of the groundwork I laid and just, you know, just trying to treat people with respect and be kind and be open. And you know, and it came back and visited me, the guy that, you know, I had met 15 years prior, and was a good, we had a mutual friend and we hung out, watched pay-per-views together a few times and stuff like that. You know, and he was, you know, he was kind of like just getting started out at New Line Cinema at the time and doing this thing. And then he gives me a call and he's, you know, a major producer at Sony Pictures. And he's just like, hey man, I got an opportunity for you. It's pretty crazy. And he goes, obviously, are you available? I said, yeah, sure. I'm available. I just been made available. And he goes, you heard of Twisted Metal? I said, yeah, the video game PlayStation is great. He's like, Sweet Tooth. And I was like, oh, I'm in. Let's do it. You know, like, so he had me read for the part and they loved it. And the rest is history.
How was that experience of doing that for you? You had to go into the studio and do it?
We did actually a lot of location shooting. So we filmed up in New Orleans and a lot of crazy, hot, sweltering days out in the sun, various locales and driving crazy Mad Max-y, rigged up with no AC cars, you know, and chasing each other in the desert. So it really, really cool from the Mad Max standpoint because, you know, it's just awesome jumping and driving cars, but pretty crazy as far as, you know, some of the crazy weather we dealt with down in Louisiana.
So did that kick in a little bit of a different, like, ooh, I'm doing something else? Did that give you any kind of a different, I don't want to say like nervous energy, but that like excited energy to be doing something different on a scale like that?
Yes, because, you know, essentially, like I've never professionally acted in at least in a television production, you know, and, you know, I have a pretty good idea of what to do out there and with people. And then, you know, the first day you're kind of sitting across from Anthony Mackie and the firing lines back and forth and, you know, these big long dialogues and, you know, I'm being dubbed over, but at the same time, you have to have the performance for the actors that are there. And for me, I just looked at it as like, well, this is just free practice. You know, worst comes to worst, they'll fix it in post, but
yeah,
you know, I'm going to give my all. And then, you know, it was cool because as we got into the production, work with these guys, learned so much. You know, you're nervous every day because obviously you don't want to let anybody down. You want to make sure that, you know,
everything's expensive.
Time is expensive. And so that was my thing. I went in there and it was a no lose situation for me and a well-paid no lose situation. So I kind of took it for everything it was and just had a lot of fun with it.
Did that, I guess, like whet your appetite for wanting to get into doing more stuff like that? And a little bit of a nice breather to not take some bumps for a while, right? Give the body a little break.
But, you know, aside from that, like just that between that and the voice acting for video games and stuff, it's just giving me a chance to be a different character. For me, that's just really exciting. It's cool just to kind of expand a little bit and do some other things, take some characters the other way. So that's the biggest benefit for me.
I'm pumped for you to get to see these opportunities and see different things kind of come your way. Because, yeah, hell yeah. It's like you plant those seeds and you wait for them to start to sprout to see what's going to take off, what's going to make sense. I really feel that for myself in the last couple of years as you like kind of drop a little seedling here and there. And then all of a sudden it's like, and it takes a while. It's never that overnight thing that just happens. It's kind of the patience that comes with that and like nurturing certain things to like have them kind of come to life.
To your point, I think is kind of what I've really learned is that, you know, I've some of the smaller moments in my life, the smaller interactions that I've had have paid off huge later on. And I never expected them to, you know, I just was trying to just be cool or say what's up or, you know, homie was righteous. All right, cool. You know, like, and a lot of that, whenever I've found myself in, I guess, career peril has just immediately materialized and like come with a lot of great offers, and a lot of great things.
It's really funny. I always feel like that's kind of happened to me too. And I guess that's just like how the world works is anytime you feel like you're like backs against a wall a little bit, you're like, oh shit, what am I going to do? And then it's like the most random thing will come through or somebody emails you or somebody calls you and you're like, whoa, the universe is weird. Not to get all like hippy dippy on it, but it is fucking trippy.
I think there's a lot of truth to that.
This year, the only app you need at your Super Bowl party is FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Download FanDuel now and use the promo code Renee, R-E-N-E-E, so that you can bet Super Bowl 57 with a no sweat first bet. You'll get up to $3,000 back in bonus bets if your first bet doesn't win. FanDuel lets you bet on everything from the money line to point spreads to who will score a touchdown. Now, all of that, it's on the top-rated sports app that's safe, secure, and super easy to use. Best of all, you can get paid your winnings instantly. So join FanDuel today with the promo code Renee, R-E-N-E-E, to claim your no sweat first bet on Super Bowl 57. Make every moment more with FanDuel, the official sportsbook partner of the NFL. Disclaimer, 21 plus in select states. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 14 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG for Colorado, Iowa, Minneapolis, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Tennessee, Virginia, and Ohio. 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 for Arizona. 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat for Connecticut. 1-800-9-WITH-IT for Indiana. Visit ksgamblinghelp.com for Kansas. 1-877-770-STOP for Louisiana. Visit www.mdgamblinghelp.org for Maryland. 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY for New York. 1-800-522-4700 for Wyoming or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net in West Virginia. You like to send weapons to my husband.
Yes, I do.
I would like to say I hate it. I don't hate it, but it does crack me up. If something just like comes to the house, it just says Mox on it. Odds are it's from you.
It's a sword, a battle axe.
Yes, which
the more ridiculous the weapon, the better. I like to send it to Mox.
And that's what it is. It's not like some like run. It's like usually some like medieval times, like some insane item. But yeah, from the what's the whip thing called again?
Shambok. Yeah.
The Shambok. We have like 10 of those in the house now. There's a blow dart.
Yeah, I sent them the blow gun. Blow gun's awesome. I mean, everybody needs one of those.
There's just so many ridiculous things. So you enjoy a good weapon. What else do you have in your garage? What kind of ridiculous items do you have that my husband has not been gifted yet so that I can prepare for these?
Oh, you sit next to me. I wish I could turn my camera. I have a bucket of weapons.
just like a red rubber bucket?
Yeah. In fact, I'll tell you, so you can throw this in post. I'll take a picture of the bucket of weapons and you can put it up on the screen. I'm a big history buff. This is where it all started. I mean, I love... You know, the great battles in history. I love, you know, reading about how societies and civilizations, you know, proceeded, migrated, conflicted, the whole nine. So, and one of the things is, you know, when you talk about medieval battles and stuff like that, you know, you don't really think about all just how crazy it really was. So, you know, you pick up a battle axe over here, let's say, and you think, actually pick one off. Give me a second here.
Let me grab my battle axe real quick. What the fuck?
So for instance, you got here a nice little Viking bearded axe and you say to yourself, wow, that's pretty cool. Now, do I go outside and hit stuff with this? No. Do I kill water bottles with it? I don't. Maybe I should. I hear it's pretty fun. But really, it's just, it boggles my mind that somebody sat in a field for 2 hours swinging this at somebody else and lived. Like, that's just wild to me. So that's kind of how it started. It was like more of like a visceral appreciation of history. But as time went on, there's various people in my life I just like to send ridiculous weapons to, just because just the conversation they have to have with their wives, like, why is there a broadsword on my front doorstep right now?
So you have other people other than John that you're sending these ridiculous things to?
No, John is currently the only guy right now.
Okay.
Yeah. There have been others in the past, but John is only the current guy that I send arms to right now.
Have you ever had any kind of incident where you've needed to call upon a weapon?
Well, this is how the whole Shambok thing got started. Was somebody had gifted me one. And so I was like, oh, wow, it's kind of a weird looking thing. And to give everybody an idea, it's basically a small medium. It's essentially a riot whip. And, you know, have a terrible history of South Africa and all this stuff. And it's a horrible weapon. But somebody decided to give me one. Of course, I decided to give one to John. But... hell of a weapon. So,
hell of a weapon.
You know, I kind of had it and just had it in my closet. Didn't really think much of it. It was just kind of, oh, cool little thing. And I remember we moved into our new home. And this was, my first son was just born. It was very, very tiny. And we're in our room and we're listening to the baby monitor. All of a sudden we hear this clack, clack, clack. So I run to the baby's room, you know, nothing's wrong. I thought fell out of the crib, something. Clack. And like, I look at my window. And somebody's like, I see a chip in the window. And I, you know, open it up and there's this guy. He's basically in the middle of the street and he's just hucking rocks at people's windows. And, you know, for whatever reason. And I remember I walked out of my house and, you know, the guy's stumbling around. He's throwing stuff. And I looked, I go, hey, MF-er, what are you doing? To which he stumbled over to me. By this point, I realized he's extremely inebriated. And he's like, oh, what are you going to? And he's kind of stumbling and bumbling. The minute he crossed the line, I said, hey, man, get the F out of here. And to which he replied, hey, F you, blah, blah, blah. And I see him go down to pick up another rock, at which point I took three steps across with the shambok, cracked him in the collarbone. And he made this unholy noise, really bad noise. It was one of the roughest noises I've ever heard a human make.
Like just like his voice making the sound or the collarbone snapping sound?
No, I didn't snap his collarbone, I don't think. But the noise he made was, people shouldn't make that noise. So I'm like, I look down at him and he's on the ground. He's messed up. And, essentially the guy was just really, really drunk and not having the best night.
Party's over, pal. Don't throw rocks at my kid's window.
Obviously, not my proudest moment, but, hey, at least I can say I sampled and tried it out. It worked.
You took it for a spin, but you were protecting your castle with your newborn baby. I mean, you kind of, I don't think you really had many choices. What's like your most prized possession of the weapons? Is there one that's just like chef's kiss?
Oh, the blowgun. It's by far the most useful. But I mean, just really great, fun.
You can get really like, you can really
pinpoint.
Yeah, the accuracy on those things is quite. We actually, our house in Vegas, we had a rat in our backyard, which is my truest nightmare. And John kept the blow dart in the yard thinking that he was going to be able to get the blow dart out fast enough to take out the rat. That never happened, but he did have high hopes that was going. I got him. I got him. No, he would have felt too bad doing it. There's no way he could have ever actually pulled the trigger to do that. He'd feel too bad.
We had a rat issue out here where they were living in. I think we told you this, where they're living out in like a palm tree.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So I'm out on my balcony and I see this giant rat that we've been trying to like catch because it's been just chewing up like
palm rats are gnarly, man. That's what we had in Vegas. They're horrible.
I had the blowgun. I had it out and I had a bead on him, but he was at the top of the tree and I hit him. And I pinned him to the tree and now I had like this little rat hanging in effigy. He just said I couldn't get him down at the top of this palm tree. And then finally a buzzard came by and ripped him off and flew away with it.
God rest his sweet little rat soul. They're just the absolute worst. I got no love for the rats. Get out of here. Okay, completely switching gears yet again as I like looked at my notes of things that I wrote down to talk to you about. Necro Butcher. So I had never seen Samoa Joe versus Necro Butcher and John made me watch it.
Was that the second date or the first date?
So what's funny about this story is that it was actually right after he had left WWE and he told me to watch it. And we're sitting at the airport and I tweeted about it and I got in so much trouble for merely tweeting Samoa Joe versus Necro Butcher. I got in trouble for that. It's violence. It is pure violence.
Good old Necro was, he didn't have the best eyesight in the world and he had a lot of enthusiasm. So that usually makes for a rough night when it comes to those punches flying in. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny, like, it was just a different internet back then. But, I thought it was a cool match and it was fun. And like, people dug it and the hot crowd and everybody was wild about it. And, fast forward, 10 odd some years, and I'm seeing like papers being written.
Oh, my God.
People doing their dissertations on it. Like making all these. Yeah, no, there literally is a
fantastic,
like somebody's dissertation to graduate. It's about Samoa Joe versus Necro Butcher and really adding so many layers of context, which I had no intention to be there. But, they interpreted it that way. So it's cool. Wow. I felt like a real artiste after I got done reading it. But yeah, I mean, it's a brawl. That's the best way I can describe it. It's just distilled down to what it needs to be. Two guys trying to knock each other's block off.
So violent, I couldn't even tweet about it. I didn't even add a graphic. I didn't even add a photo or nothing. I just, that's all I said, and I got in trouble for it. What stands out to you as some of the programs that you're most proud of that you did through your whole career? I mean, God, there's so many to think of, but like, what are the ones that you really kind of harken back to?
A lot of stuff I did with AJ, at any company or any form, it's always been great. Kurt Angle, TNA, Brock and WWE. Those are kind of things that stand out where it was like really engaging programs with guys who just want to go out there and tear the place down. So it was, those were all really fun to me.
Like, is there any kind of like thing you didn't get to turn over, like some other kind of match you wanted to have, someone you wanted to wrestle. I mean, now when you look at the roster of AEW, like I said, there's so many new guys, there's young guys, there's different styles, et cetera, et cetera. We're having so many more guys come in from Japan, all that. Is there anybody that you really want to kind of tie it up with out there?
I can kind of name off a laundry list of dudes who, you know, would kind of fit that bill. Like where I'm at now, it's like, whoever you put me in front of, you know, whoever you put me with, I want to make that awesome. You know, it's kind of like, I don't think there needs to be perfect ingredients to make the best dish. I just think you got to cook them the right way. So, I mean, that's kind of where my mind's at right now. Like it's definitely not on, oh, I want this dream match and I want that dream match. No, I want whoever they put me with. I want to turn that into something. You know, we kind of got that started here with Darby Allin. I think when you, on paper before we ever locked up that matchup doesn't seem like, you know, it's, you know, just because of, you know, whatever preconceptions that you may have with either one of us. And, you know, kind of getting there now after two matches going into our third here, I think that opinion and that view of it is very, very different. And now it's something that's kind of sought after and people want to see.
Do you feel any kind of responsibility with your position in AEW and all the experience that you have to really get some guys to, I guess, like a passing of the torch, so to speak, with some of those guys, or getting people in like that sweet spot, or like setting that locker room standard? Because wrestling, grizzled old vet over here, it has changed a lot in the last little while. But what do you like? Do you feel any responsibility to sort of set the standard, whether it's in the ring, in the locker room, et cetera, et cetera?
It's unusual for me to think of it that way, because it means that you're kind of setting a ceiling on certain people. You know, to me, I'd rather go in there and work with people and then have them discover things, you know, two or three things or something about a way of doing a program, a different way to skin the cat. That's my biggest thing, is that, you know, if I can work with guys and show them different ways of kind of accomplishing what they want to accomplish, you know, alternative ways. And that's kind of my big thing. You know, I don't think there's one right way to do things. And I think it's pretty egotistical to think that there is. But I do believe there are some proven methods that can work and that can be integrated into what people do. And that's kind of been my biggest thing, is I'm not trying to tell people how you're supposed to do things, but, you know, I will offer some alternatives and other ways to do things. And that's really what my focus has been, is just trying to expand their mind a little bit along with mine and put together good matches.
You and I were watching Mark Briscoe and Jay Lethal at TV the other week. What are some of your memories of Jay Briscoe? I know you got to obviously be a part of so many different things with Ring of Honor, and I saw the video package and stuff that AEW put together, but some memories that you have of Jay Briscoe.
You know, I think the biggest memory of Jay, and I think, you know, like I said, why a lot of us were, you know, really floored by this, is that, you know, Jay was a guy who was unconditionally loved people. He'd come in and it didn't matter if you're having a good day or a bad day. You know, he was always there to be like, hey, how you doing, man? And, you know, dap you up, give you a hug. You know, you shoot the bull with him, what happened down at the chicken farm, which is always wild stories. You know what I mean? Like, they always had like, you know, hey, what was we going down the farm? Oh, man. You know, like, and it was just like, you know, I think that was the biggest thing. It was just, you know, Jay was extremely authentic. You know, like I said, we're all going to miss him, just because just the fun, the hilarity, you know, like the good times after the show, the great matches. It's just, all that kind of goes away. It leaves a big void. And I think that's why it hit a lot of people so hard.
It's funny. The first time I like saw the Briscoes, I'm really sad that I didn't ever get to work with them in any capacity. I've only met Mark for the first time when we were at TV the other week. But just a huge fan, and obviously such a huge loss to the wrestling community. Okay. So we're early on in the year. What do you want to accomplish this year? What does 2023 look like for Samoa Joe?
You know, obviously we're always hunting championships. And, you know, when we get our television championship back and our TNT title back together. And honestly, I'm at a point now where I'm having a lot of fun, you know, especially at AEW. And we as performers, sometimes we get caught up in our own BS, you know, a little bit too much. And I think, you know, sometimes we don't present ourselves in the best possible way in the public eye, knowing that, you know, we provide a service. You know, we're out there to entertain people and to make people happy. And a lot of that is, you know, kind of keeping up our own appearances and stuff like that. And though, while I don't tell everybody never to, you know, hide your feelings or suppress your feelings, you know, I think sometimes we share too much. You know, they don't need to know that me and Delta got a beef on Thursday. Like, that's going to fix anything. Because trust me, I've seen everybody try to do it, and they do not move any faster if you call them out on social media. You know, that just, So, I mean, that's kind of my thing. I'm keeping it very positive in the sense that, you know, I've been blessed and fortunate to be in a career where I get to go out and entertain millions of people every week. And I've managed to stay in this career for much longer than what is expected. And, you know, I just want to continue to do that at the very best level that I can.
It just made me think of you like joining AEW, because I feel like, and I could be wrong, but I feel like you were maybe at a point that you were considering maybe hanging up the boots. What was it about AEW that made you want to keep going? If that was the case, maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, all the money they threw at me. I mean, immediately threw all my morals away and all my... No.
Hey, we got to get paid. I mean, you already said you come at a steep price, so...
No, I was legitimately thinking about hanging it up, you know, for health reasons, you know, obviously still coming off the concussion and still, you know, dealing with just the very, you know, end effects of that and getting back in the ring healthy and like transitioning back to in a physical state where it's like, you know, I could do something for a good period of time and like not... like want to pass out.
What was that like being at home kind of struggling with that? Because again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I know you got hurt in the ring, but then you also got hurt on a shoot as well, right?
Yeah, on a commercial shoot. Yeah. But essentially, you know, a table didn't break like it was supposed to. And I basically caught two concussions very close together, which is terrible. To that point though, you know, I did take a year off doing commentary, maybe a year and a half off, which helped me tremendously. And I do not regret taking that time. I wouldn't change it for anything. That allowed me to get healthy, get my mind back together, get back into a place where I felt confident even doing anything physical. And I realized if I would have rushed out and I would have done that, I probably inevitably would have not returned to the ring at all. So I am happy I handled that well, despite wanting to kind of get after it. And like,
when you say you handled it well, like what, you were just like happy to be doing what you're like, you were happy to be in the commentary position. You're happy to still like be in the fold of things. Like, were there some internal struggles of what that was like? Cause I mean, getting into the commentary world, as I can attest to, is like, it can be a doozy. It can be a lot. And transitioning into that, when I'm sure you're used to being on like the physical side of things, was it hard to call matches when you want to be out there doing it? Or was it just kind of fun to flex that new muscle?
No, I think if anything, the hardest part about commentary is a man in your ear. I mean, you can attest to that. And it's just because, you know, he's very exacting. He wants what he wants. No beef with that. I mean, okay, I get it. You know, I just thought about what I'd want people to say about me when I was in there. And that really was kind of my main focal point is like, you know, if I'm, you know, so-and-so, how would I want to be talked about if I was in the ring? If I was on top and I was putting on pressure and beating up this guy, how would I want that described? And really, that's kind of the mindset I took into it. I wanted to enhance whatever, you know, performer was in that ring. I wanted to enhance, you know, how they appeared in the fan. And that was really kind of the only thing that I really had, you know, the only singular concept I kind of tried to keep in my mind while I was doing it. But I enjoyed it. You know, it was a great time. I was working with great people. You know, Michael Cole is probably a guy that is really unheralded.
Oh my God, what a guy. I feel like I talk about how much I love Michael Cole all the time, but like he's truly exceptional.
I gained so much respect for Michael Cole and seeing what he actually does for the company. Like, you know, and it goes far beyond the camera and whatever. And, you know, seeing what he has to put up with and seeing what he has to deal with. And yeah. You know, like I realized this is a man who like anybody else in the world would have broke under the pressure that he's put on under consistently week after week after week. And just he was a big help too, because like he fully believed in me, you know, did everything he can to put me in the best position to succeed. And he made that transition very easy.
While we're talking about you on commentary, I would be remiss to not bring up the braid. Why did you lose the braid? Can we bring the braid back? Because I was a fan.
So braid was lost because of Twisted Metal.
Because with a head of hair like that, not a lot of guys are lucky to have the follicles that you have. And I feel like it's a little bit of a slap in the face to just get rid of the beautiful hair.
I think throughout my career, I've had a bevy of wild hairstyles. So, and it runs the gamut from shaved head to mohawks to color red mohawks to all kinds of stuff. So my hairstyle is really just how I'm feeling that week. I make weird decisions and I come home and my wife just stares at me.
How does your wife react to like watching you wrestle and stuff now? Like, how has her relationship with your career changed over the years?
Nothing bothers her. She knows when I'm hurt. It's amazing. She's better than most people in the business. Like, she can tell when I'm hurt, I'm not. And like, there's some things I've taken where she's just been like, everybody in the room thought I was dead. And she's like, he's fine. You know? And then there's times where I'm legitimately hurt and I'll get a text from her. You're hurt, aren't you? Yeah. So she's a grizzled old vet. You know, like, what can I say? She's seen it all. I mean, and like I said, she's known me for years, even before my career. And, you know, seeing me bloody, bruised, cut up, sliced up has been the majority of her time seeing me in life. So it's just really no surprise to her.
It's an old hat for her. That just reminded me of the time that I got kicked in the face on commentary. You were the only person. You're like, are you okay? You texted me. You're like, what the fuck?
Did you just get kicked in the head, dude? Is your dome cool? Boot.
Fucking got my ass. Slow-mo that shit. And I didn't even get a bloody nose. Some bullshit. Anyways, listen, I could have you on here and shoot the shit with you all day and probably tell a bunch of stories that we shouldn't tell. But I will let you go back to your off day. I appreciate you jumping on here.
You know, I got to admit, I'm surprised you didn't bring up my sparkling Canadian racism.
Well, I started to when I said you have all these really offensive burns towards me. I guess I can say what they were. They're not actually offensive. This fucking guy, this sat with me for a week. And I said it to John. I was like, you know what Joe called me this week? He called me a snowback maple sucker. Am I allowed to say that? I'm allowed to say it, right?
You're allowed to say it. That's why I told it to you, because I knew it would be like a brain infection in you and you couldn't not say it.
Well, because it was a clever burn. Like, you can't help but laugh because it sounds so derogatory and really so does. Rude. But it's very funny.
Well, I think when I called you the representative from the Moose Appreciation Society, I kind of got you.
I wish you like, well, I'm not going to change my Twitter bio. But to it's that, only because, it
you, as you know, I love Canada.
I know you love Canada.
I do. I'm a huge, I got my boys in Toronto, have a good time up there. Vancouver, just that was, you know, it's best. On the West Coast. That was kind of my first little foray up there. So. I have a lot of fun in Canada.
We're going to Canada soon. Canadian We've friends, got like a big all. Loop in Canada. I know, so I can't buckle wait. Up for let's go get some Caesars and some poutines.
We're going to get some ketchup chips and we're going to get some poutine.
I cannot wait. I'm so pumped. I need to like drop 5 pounds so that I can put 10 on.
Are we going to Montreal? Should we get some smoked meat?
No, we're not doing Montreal. We do like Toronto, Hamilton, Regina, Saskatoon.
The salt of the earth Canadians.
Yes. Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, we're doing it. Yeah. All right, go swing your axe handles around or whatever weapons you have there, and I'll see you at TV.
Yes, you will.
Thank you. Thank you to Joe for taking the time on a day off to hang out with me, shoot the shit, talk his career, talk about all those many different topics that we kind of sashayed around. So thanks to Joe for hanging out with me, and thanks to you guys for also hanging out. And don't forget, if you're liking things here on The Sessions and you want another platform to listen to or hang out, download the AMP app, hang out with us there Tuesdays, Thursdays, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. We will be there. I was going to say be there or be square, and it just is lame, but now it's already left my mouth. So, you know, just be there. You don't have to be square. You can if you want, but just be there or here, whatever you guys want. It's your show. Do what you want with it. Listen to the podcast when you want to, where you want to. That's the beauty of it all, right? All right, guys, until next time, this has been The Sessions.